Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to talk about various pieces of the kingdom that are under assault at the moment, and who better to think our way through all of them with than our resident genius, and that would be, of course, George Raceley. He usually giggles when I say that about him, but the Mensa Society says it's so, so it must be so. He certainly is a man of considerable intellect as well as great expertise in the political world especially. We rely on George's insights based in part on his experience with some 300 campaigns at various levels of the government, all the way up to President of the United States. He's had time on Capitol Hill in both the Senate and House, as well as he has served as an aide to the Vice President of the United States. And these days, he's aiding us big time. George Raceley, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Well, thank you, Frank. And despite appearances, I have not abandoned the good fight for the golf course.
I know you have not. You are a man who is in the fight at all times. George, speaking of the fight, something that's been going on lately in the United States Supreme Court is a fight over whether the government of Joe Biden, or any government of the United States for that matter, can have people basically contracted out to censor others the administration wishes to suppress. The states of Missouri and Louisiana have brought cases on this subject. Mm-hmm. I think you're tracking it at the abstract level. You may or may not be following every jot and tittle, but what's at stake here, George? And where should the court come down, do you think?
Well, you know, as a free speech absolutist, I think the court should clearly agree with Missouri and Louisiana and bar the federal government from engaging in the conduct that the Biden administration did or has done and potentially still doing. I think, you know, based on what I've seen of the reporting on the arguments before the court, there was some skepticism on the part of the justices on, you know, how far they might be willing to limit the government from, in essence, contacting social media companies. And it really kind of gets down to longstanding policies. I mean, the government, you know, going back to the foundation of the Republic, has always manipulated the media. And so the question is, at what point does that become First Amendment problematic censorship? And what does it, and at what point does it remain legitimate, the government getting out its necessary views and opinions? I would argue that the government's views and opinions are certainly not superior to any citizen's views and opinions, but it doesn't seem, at least from the reporting on the arguments before the court, that a majority of justices were willing to go quite that far.
Well, you don't have to be an absolutist to think that if the government's opinion trumps your own, that does give rise to almost certainly a restraint on free speech.
And, absolutely.
I would hope that these originalists, who now are supposed to have a majority of the court, would so find. Mm-hmm. But we'll be watching it closely. George, I wanted to ask you about another matter. Speaking of free speech absolutists, one of our colleagues, Bill Walton, had a conversation with me the other day in which he talked about his concerns about the bill on TikTok that has been approved by the House of Representatives on a substantial bipartisan majority vote. His argument is basically that the language seems to allow the Biden administration to essentially shut down any social media platform that it deems to be foreign controlled. And it is pointed out that Rumble, with its Canadian ownership, could be a candidate for that kind of control, as could be Truth Social, on the grounds that Donald Trump is controlled by the Russians, as you know. What do you make of these concerns? And more broadly, do you sympathize with the idea that it is a restriction of free speech to deprive 173 million Americans, we're told, of their TikTok addiction?
Well, the bill, as I read it, doesn't deprive anybody of anything other than it deprives the communist Chinese from profiting off of the addictive and disinformational characteristics of TikTok. And so the bill would potentially require TikTok to be divested from ByteDance or ByteDance, which is a Chinese communist controlled corporation. TikTok's merely one of its products, in essence. And so, you know, I understand where people are coming from of not trusting the Biden administration on that, for sure.
And, well, George, let me ask you this. As I was listening, we did a really interesting Committee on the Present Danger China webinar, and you're an important member of that team. So appreciate your help with it. That we did on last week, talking about TikTok. It was right after, as it happens, the House approved this legislation. Mm-hmm. But I must tell you that I think I follow this pretty closely. But in addition to the problem that you've touched on of an addictive algorithm designed, in effect, to sink the Chinese Communist Party's claws into users, gaining access to all kinds of big data from them, and to then inseminate them with maybe subliminal, maybe not so subliminal propaganda. There's also a quality, when you put all this together, of mind control that is in the hands of the Chinese Communist Party as well. How serious a problem do you think that constitutes, especially if, as I know you're a serious student of, it could be weaponized in the course of the upcoming fall election, for example?
Well, it most certainly could be weaponized in the course of the upcoming fall election, and it really is a form of cognitive warfare, if you will. And it has the ability, because of its immersive nature, to definitely influence how people think, how people perceive reality. And that could have a big impact on elections. It could have a big impact on a lot of other political behavior.
Is it overstating the case that even if you take care of all of the other problems, the mail-in ballots, the machines, the voter IDs, the dead people on the rolls, all the rest of them, that this might prove and the means of absolutely stealing elections in the future? As one of our friends pointed out, I mean, these are people who are casting legal ballots and seemingly doing so voluntarily, but they may be doing it under orders that they're not aware of.
Yeah, well, they very well may be doing it under the influence of a malign actor. And that's the Chinese Communist Party.
That would be our mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party. Yep. George, we have to take a very short break. We're going to come right back and we're going to talk about something else that's pretty malign, and that's what Tyson Foods is up to at the moment. Stay tuned for that and more with George Rason. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. For 3 decades, the Chinese Communist Party has been waging what it calls unrestricted warfare against the United States. The objective has been to destroy America without firing a shot. The CCP is poised to win a possibly decisive battle in that war just 67 days from now, as usual, with Team Biden's stealthy help. The plan is to approve in Geneva at the end of May what amount to not one but 2 treaties that would surrender a key element of our national sovereignty and your freedoms, namely public health decision-making, to a Marxist Ethiopian bureaucrat who the CCP made leader of the World Health Organization. Congress has a chance to derail this global governance gambit on Friday by affirming House-passed legislation to cut off all funding to the WHO. Tell your representative you want sovereignty, not surrender, at sovereigntycoalition.org. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We are visiting with John Leake. He is the co-author with Dr. Peter McCullough of The Courage to Face COVID-19. It's about the preventing of hospitalization and death while battling the biopharmaceutical complex. And I want to talk with you a bit more about this biopharmaceutical complex, John, in a moment. But just staying with this general observation, you've just basically described, I think, in your analysis of this effort to suppress truth-telling, something that is a thwart not only really our Constitution and our whole concept of free speech and the free thought that it facilitates, but it's the scientific method as well that would seem to be impinged greatly upon by these kinds of censorship. And I know Peter McCullough, your co-author and a marvelous individual in every respect, but particularly as a medical practitioner, was very severely censored and censured, for that matter, for his truth-telling about COVID-19. Informed by both his experience and now yours, what does it tell us about where we wind up if we do, in fact, go down this road of saying the government can pull these strings, either on the basis of its own say-so or that of the World Health Organization?
It's notable if you study the history of science and then the history of medicine, I'd say really starting in the 19th century, again and again and again, you see discerning, talented, industrious guys. The two notable ones that I'm very interested in, I've read everything there is to read about them. One is Ignaz Semmelweis in Vienna. He observed that if students will wash their hands with chlorinated lime after anatomy class, after examining cadavers in an anatomy class, before they examine pregnant women in the obstetrics ward, it will cut down on infection of pregnant women. And this was in the late 1840s. At the time, the eminences of Europe in medical schools, including the University of Vienna, said Semmelweis is crazy for proposing hand washing. Semmelweis ended up dying in an insane asylum. John Snow in London, he observed this cholera outbreak in Soho. He heard intelligence, a woman had washed an infant's diaper in the water well. He said, shut down the water well. Cholera seems to be waterborne. And they said, what are you, crazy, Dr. Snow? Cholera is not waterborne, it's airborne, it's a miasma. Well, so Snow was right, he was proven correct by Dr. Koch in Germany 30 years later, who actually observed the cholera bacillus. So time and again, the discerning individual is proven right. So if
you don't have to go back that far. You can look in our own time at people who were intensely indoctrinated to believe that ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine were not only not the safe readily available, inexpensive therapies that would work against COVID-19. They were told that their horse medications or otherwise, you know, possibly, you know, inappropriate for use in this kind of circumstance. I think your own Dr. McCullough was among those who recognized that these could, if used early on, make a profound difference in the course of treatment, right?
You're right.
And they've been proven right.
Well, and that's the heart of my book with Dr. McCullough. I mentioned the previous historical figures because I believe ultimately what we're going to see here is that it will once again be the realization, like the connection with cigarette smoking and cancer. What was controversial 30 years ago is now universally accepted to be the truth of the matter.
Provided you can make people aware of it, provided that, you know, it's tested in the crucible of the give and take of free thinking and free ideas. John, this brings me to I think it's pretty clear, the villains of your tale with Peter McCullough, and that's Big Pharma. Big Pharma is now a very prime funder of the World Health Organization. And it's very interesting that while it clearly has benefited, you talk about the biopharmaceutical complex, it has benefited from that relationship, I think not least by what we were talking about, the suppression of these cheap therapies in favor of these expensive and dangerous so-called vaccines. But John, the interesting thing is, in this World Health Organization amendment and treaty process that again, folks, is supposed to be consummated at the end of May of this year, and all other things being equal, will almost certainly wind up being approved and therefore imposed upon us. But the pharmaceutical industry is apparently at the moment now squealing like stuck pigs over the idea that they're going to have to make their proprietary information about their drugs and about the research and so on widely available to the planet. Talk a little bit about this, and is this sort of poetic justice to your way of thinking?
Well, I would first like to just define the biopharmaceutical complex. We borrowed that term from Eisenhower's farewell address in 1959, in which he warned the American people about the undue influence of what he called the military-industrial complex, this kind of symbiotic relationship of the defense industry with the Department of Defense, with government, you know, the Treasury. And he said, these guys, you know, I'm concerned there's undue influence that is being amassed by this complex. And Dr. McCullough and I perceive that the biopharmaceutical complex is an outgrowth, a sort of adjunct of the military-industrial complex. And I think the key point is when an emergency, a public emergency, is declared, and the really clever legislation was the PREP Act of 2005. Once Health and Human Services declares a public health emergency, then it's basically a wartime situation. The proposition is it's like the country's being invaded, not by armed men, but by an invisible pathogen. So there's extraordinary power that's then given to the executive. And anyone who's in the business of making so-called countermeasures, any kind of product or action to counter this invasion of invisible pathogens, is then absolved of any liability. And the government pays for the countermeasure. So nice work. If you can get it.
Yeah, exactly right. So, but here's the rub. If the WHO agreements come into effect, do you anticipate that one of two things will happen? Big Pharma has to give up its secrets in the name of equity. or that we will find them ceasing to do the kind of work that we do need them to do in this biopharmaceutical complex.
I mean, there is so much subterfuge and misrepresentation going on in all of this. I would not take any statements as state value, at face value. I would be very concerned that this is some kind of smoke and mirror show. I mean, the one thing I've learned about the biopharmaceutical complex is whatever representations they make, I mean, most of the time, it's a distortion of reality.
It may be downright untrue. Yeah. John, we'll be watching it closely. It may well be that they just drop that provision because it offends their big funders. We'll be watching it, and I know you will be too. Thank you for your time today, my friend, and the great work you do with Dr. Peter McCullough.
Who Thanks, Frank. Here.
Come back to us again soon.
Good to see you. Thank you.
We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and a woman I have come to admire greatly, and now consider, I'm privileged to say, to be a personal friend, as well as an inspiring mentor, is with us. Her name is Dr. Meryl Ness. She is a medical doctor by training. She is a frontline doctor who has been sanctioned by the medical authorities in her native state of Maine. Her license has been suspended since January of 2022. For prescribing impermissible therapies that would have saved people's lives had they been widely dispensed. But thanks to the advice of the World Health Organization, that was not permissible. And we're going to talk about why, under the circumstances in which people needlessly died by the hundreds of thousands, we have an idea now in play that the WHO should be actually given the authority to dictate to us when we have a public health emergency of international concern and what we must do about it. Dr. Ness, having time heavy on her hands because she's not practicing medicine at the moment, has thrown herself into the effort to spare our people this wholly unconstitutional, and I believe downright dangerous, assault on our sovereignty, on states' rights, and not least on our medical freedoms. And we salute her for doing all of that. A wonderful resource for more information on what the problems are here and what needs to be done about them is one she created called Door to Freedom. You can find it at doortofreedom.org, and we're delighted to have her with us for an extended conversation about her work, about the problems we're facing, and the imperative need for all of you to do a couple of very, very easy things to try to make a difference in how this all turns out. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But first, Dr. Meryl Ness, welcome back to Securing America. It's great to have you with us.
Hey, glad to be here again, Frank.
Thank you. Let me start, Meryl, by setting the stage a little bit. As we are speaking, there is legislation that is somewhere in the bowels of the Capitol being taken up, or at least being massaged, to reconcile a very important difference between the House version of the fiscal year 2024 Foreign Operations Appropriations Bill and whatever is the Senate position at the moment. They didn't do an appropriations bill, but they've got some thoughts about what they'd like to have come out of all of this that will probably be voted on at the end of the week on Friday in some form or another. Tell us about these differences and why they matter so much, Meryl.
Yes, on September 28th, the House of Representatives actually voted in favor of defunding the WHO and also requiring that a WHO pandemic treaty be put in front of the Senate for its advice and consent. That means the Senate would have to ratify it. Otherwise, the Biden administration had planned to simply get a signature from the State Department and call it good for this treaty that could affect all of us in very profound ways and is furthermore unconstitutional. So the Republican majority...
Can I just ask a question on this point? The way I read the language in the House version, it would apply as well to the agreement amending international health regulations. Am I misreading that?
I don't know. I'm not sure because...
It seemed as though they made a kind of sweeping description of any agreement or accord or framework or other things. So I think it would capture both. It should, that's for sure.
I really hope so because yeah. Both the amendments to the international health regulations and the new pandemic treaty are both, according to international law, international treaties, but they have been named in such
a way. So says the Congressional Research Service, no less. So
yes,
we have it on
yes.
good authority.
On right? two occasions. But one is called an agreement and the other one is called regulations. And so the Biden administration had hoped to treat them as if all they would require is a signature from the State Department. And we think both of them, which are, they're very intertwined. They overlap. They cover some of the same things. Each requires the other. But either one, if it passes, will be extremely deleterious to freedom in the United States. So anyway, we really
I call it
need...
kind of a belt and suspenders kind of approach to
exactly.
make sure that they get this done, right? But either one, as you say, is a problem. So to the extent that the House measure became the law of the land, meaning the Senate would go along with it, meaning the president would sign it into law, you would still have us members of the World Health Organization. We wouldn't be funding it, at least, but would we still be subject to whatever the rest of the outfit, the World Health Assembly, as it's called, which will be meeting at the end of May, decides to approve?
So I guess it depends whether we're putting these treaties in front of the Senate or not, because it would need 67 members of the Senate to approve for it to go forward. And I think they would have trouble, but maybe it's possible to get 67 members. But
not if we do our job, my dear, that's for sure.
Exactly. The problem with simply defunding the WHO is that does not make your nation either leave the organization or not be subject to its orders or dictates. If either of these documents goes through, they're both intended to be binding on all the nations or parties. And dues or no dues, you know, we will have to abide by them.
Yeah. And as I understand it, it takes quite some time to extricate yourself from them if you decide you actually don't want to be bound by
yes.
them.
So again, the WHO, when it was founded and it had has a constitution since 1948, there is no way to get out within the WHO system and its constitution. And for this proposed pandemic treaty, once you're in, which takes a month after 40 nations have ratified or signed it, then it will take a minimum of 2 years and possibly three. There's some wiggle room because they're negotiating that amount of time. But in some versions of the treaty, it says three, in some versions two, and in the latest version, which came out a week ago, it's not clear. They've split it. They've left both open.
So let's talk a bit about what these provisions are and what they would do to our country if they were to become binding upon it. Starting with the point that I made earlier, that Tedros Ghebreyesus, the Director General of the organization, would be given these sweeping new powers. You, of course, as a frontline doctor, have a particularly clear-eyed view of what he was able to do when he was simply playing an advisory role,
right,
in the pandemic. Talk a little bit about that experience and what it suggests would happen going forward. Should he have these new powers?
Right. Yeah. During COVID, the WHO was in an advisory position only. It could not give orders to the nations about how to manage COVID. But most nations, certainly the developed ones, decided to follow the WHO, which is interesting in itself because the WHO does not have a lot of expertise to be able to make decisions about what countries should do. There are very few infectious disease doctors on the staff. Any state in the United States probably has more expertise than the WHO. Why would you listen to the WHO? They are certainly not familiar with the different circumstances in 194 different member nations. Why would you want...
Not even Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus?
Who we are now calling Dr. Who. Dr. Who does not have a medical degree.
He doesn't. Huh, sink me. So neither he nor his staff is particularly expert in all of this, and yet they would, in his person specifically, have the authority to describe, to declare a public health emergency. And as I understand it, that doesn't necessarily mean a pandemic of some kind. Is that right? Could it be more sweeping than that?
Well, he's declared three public health emergencies of international concern in the 6 years he's been in office. Monkeypox was one of them. He went against his advisory committee, which twice said there was no emergency. There will be no standards in the current versions of the amendments and treaty that we've seen. He can declare one at any time for any reason.
And I understand, for example, that he has already been talking up climate change, for example,
yes,
as a public health emergency of international concern. What does that mean if he has the authority to direct what must be done in response to something that clearly is not about health in the first instance, at least?
Well, what they've done, what not only Tedros, but the negotiators and drafters of these documents have done is to expand the definition of health and expand the definition of what he can do. So he's no longer limited to public health emergencies, but any risk that has the potential to affect health, right? Which is almost anything, right? Diet, climate, biodiversity, guns, right? All of those now fall within his purview, and he can then decide whatever he wants to make us do to manage whatever he declares is a public health emergency or potential for an emergency.
Now, I think you said this earlier, but just to put a fine point on it, this sounds utterly unconstitutional. We're going to talk on the other side of this short break with Meryl Nass about the implications of allowing them to get away with it. The implications, excuse me. We're going to talk on the other side of this short break about the implications of letting them get away with it. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. For three decades, the Chinese Communist Party has been waging what it calls unrestricted warfare against the United States. The objective has been to destroy America without firing a shot. The CCP is poised to win a possibly decisive battle in that war just 67 days from now, as usual, with Team Biden's stealthy help. The plan is to approve in Geneva at the end of May what amount to not one but two treaties that would surrender a key element of our national sovereignty and your freedoms, namely public health decision-making, to a Marxist Ethiopian bureaucrat who the CCP made leader of the World Health Organization. Congress has a chance to derail this global governance gambit on Friday by affirming House-passed legislation to cut off all funding to the WHO. Tell your representative you want sovereignty, not surrender, at sovereigntycoalition.org. This is Frank Gaffney. We're back with Dr. Merrill Nass, a courageous and quite visionary medical doctor who practices or has practiced in the state of Maine, where she resides. She's not doing it now because the medical authorities disapproved of her efforts to give her patients the best medical advice she could to fulfill the Hippocratic oath she swore. Which is a point that I think can't be overstated in terms of its importance, Merrill Nass. The patient-doctor relationship seems to me to be one of the things that's in extreme peril if Dr. Ghebreyesus is appointed to be effectively everybody's new doctor. How would that work in practice, do you think?
It's very simple how it would work and very disturbing. So he could tell us what medicines we must use if he declares a pandemic, and he can tell us what medicines we will not be allowed to use. Can you imagine that anyone would have, and particularly a non-doctor, could tell us what we're not allowed to use? I mean, if a drug is licensed and a practitioner is licensed and the patient and the doctor want a certain drug, they have every right to get them. And now somebody who isn't a doctor, who is, you know, dancing to the tune of his funders, major among them being Bill Gates, will have the right to tell us we have to have certain vaccines and we're not allowed to have ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine. I mean, this is a power not even the President of the United States has. Why should this unelected bureaucrat at the WHO have that power?
Unelected and wholly unaccountable, as well as having a rather dubious background, it seems to me. In addition to not being a medical doctor, he's a Marxist out of Ethiopia, who some accuse of terrorism. It's just unbelievable. So, Merrill, you dealt with patients, and they came to you in the course of the COVID crisis, and they expected you to give them not only your best advice, but the medicines that you thought would most fit the bill. Now, these were what were called off-label uses of ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, right? But does that alter the professional responsibility to make them available if you saw fit to meet your patient's needs?
You know, doctors seem to have forgotten that they've taken an oath, and that oath is about them being wholly responsible to the patient in front of them, not to their employer, not to some insurance company, not to a pharmaceutical company, and certainly not to the uneducated head of the WHO. And my responsibility to the patient is also to give them the best information I have. What these treaties would do is enable the WHO to impose surveillance and censorship on everybody in the world and not allow information about health options that are against what the WHO is recommending. So let me say that again.
Let's break that down because it is so important. Please, I was going to ask you to say it again, and then let's separate it out of and address each of these components.
Right. So the WHO is directing nations to surveil the social media presence of their citizens. And if misinformation or disinformation or too much information is being spread, they are required to censor it in both the treaty and the International Health Regulation amendments. That means
okay. So you're saying that our country—it's
very important for them. They want every country to impose surveillance and censorship on all citizens around the world.
So let me come back to the surveillance point. Just on the censorship point, where as we're speaking, the Supreme Court has been reviewing cases that have exposed our government engaging in impermissible censorship, in my view, impermissible censorship with tech companies to suppress the kind of information that the World Health Organization didn't want challenged in the past, and Tony Fauci and others. And so, Merrill, you're saying that under this new treaty or this new set of amendments to the underlying World Health International Health Regulations, they would be able to trample permanently on our First Amendment freedoms, irrespective of what the Supreme Court says about these cases?
That is the intention. And it is a warning that our own federal government is basically in cahoots with the WHO and has pushed for this. We like it. And the officials of the U.S. government who have gone before Congress, our own people, yes, our diplomats who are negotiating this are in favor of these sorts of provisions that trample on the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. This is our First Amendment right, which says clearly that the federal government cannot censor Americans. I mean, it's so well established. And most of the states say the same thing.
But Merrill, but now, when three of these diplomats appeared before a congressional committee led by Congressman Brad Wenstrup, when asked, would these arrangements have any impact on our sovereignty? As I understand it, the committee was assured that they would not. So you're saying that in addition to some very problematic provisions, we've been deceived about their impact?
Yes. The only way you could get these two documents through is through deceit. I mean, their provisions are so egregious. They are taking us into a potential digital gulag where everyone will be surveilled. You know, what we can say is to be limited. The medicines we can have are limited. The lockdowns can be imposed. Border closures can be imposed. Drugs and vaccines can be given to us without licenses and with no liability.
Okay, stop. I have to ask for your pause. We'll come back and pick up on this litany, but it's so shocking and so outrageous that we're being deceived about it, that we're going to find out what we need to do about all of this with Dr. Merrill Nass right after this. Stay tuned. Welcome back. Dr. Merrill Nass is in the house, I'm very pleased to say. Merrill is one of the principal leaders of our sovereignty coalition that has done incalculably important work, I think, in helping to elevate the kinds of problems that she has just described. Her own relatively new organization, Door to Freedom, has been a central partner in all of this, and we're so appreciative of all your work, Doctor. Let me just ask you to further elaborate a bit on this digital gulag idea. Gulag, of course, is a term from the old Soviet era, the prison system that they had there. The idea that digital IDs could be used not simply to monitor public health and the possibility that pandemics or whatever are breaking loose, but to actually control populations is what gives rise, I think, to this gulag idea, does it not? And talk a little bit about how that would work and what the World Health Organization is doing to put it into place as we speak.
What we have is a model in China where people are controlled through their digitally and through their ability to spend money. So if you have annoyed the powers that be, you are not able to buy a plane ticket or a train ticket or a bus ticket, and your children can't go to the right school, things like this. You may not be able to work and get a job. So how will you support yourself? What's happening now is that this is possibly being expanded to the rest of the world. The European Union paid to have a vaccine passport developed, which they wanted to use, and they rolled out in some countries. But of course, you know, the vaccines didn't work. The vaccine passport didn't give you any guarantee of anything. And so this all faded away. But as the passports expired, the EU made an agreement with the WHO and turned their whole passport system, vaccine passport system, over to the WHO, which is calling it by several names, including a digital ID. And the WHO has said that 1 billion people in the world are suffering because they don't have proof that they exist. There's no birth certificate for them. There's no social security number, and they are desperately in need of a digital ID so that they can buy train tickets, etc. This may or may not be true. I've never met anyone who complained that they didn't have an identity, but anyway, the WHO is trying to roll out the old vaccine passport to everybody in the world. And isn't it surprising? It has a functionality so that it can act as a digital wallet and you can pay for things with it. And this is a mechanism by which everyone could be controlled. It would be your guarantee that you were vaccinated. It would be your digital ID, whatever that is. And it would be your digital money, and you would then be able to be controlled by a digital gulag.
Which, again, is not some hypothetical concept. That's actually what is operating today in communist China. They call it the social credit system. And you're saying, Merrill, that basically the infrastructure for a global social credit system is what is being actually put into place by the World Health Organization today. And what you've described, I mean, it is no exaggeration to say it's a gulag, and especially when you overlay on top of it things like central bank digital currency, you really can see this enforced with cutting off the access to your money. So again, in so many respects, Merrill, this is obviously not something that the public would countenance if only they knew about it.
Right. If they understood
the implications. We have 10 weeks. Yeah. We have 10 weeks to try to essentially bring forth all of this evidence and information and make people, I think, reflect on how this will impact their own lives. And just to put it in a minute or so, how would you characterize the difference between life as we know it in America today and the life that we would be condemned to lead under the dictatorship of Tedros Ghebreyesus?
Well, you could say goodbye to the doctor-patient relationship because your doctor would only be allowed to prescribe what he's told to prescribe and would not be able to access information about hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin. So those options would go out the window.
And they stand to be punished rather severely if they...
Like me. Like me.
Yeah,
they would no longer practice medicine if they were in my shoes. In addition, the WHO... isn't telling us exactly what this is going to cost, but people have estimated the cost will be about 10 times the current WHO budget. And so dues will have to go up, financing will need to be arranged, and you and I will need to pay more taxes. In addition, because of many other provisions, such as the demand that nations roll out vaccines and drugs that have not been tested or tested properly, maybe not at all, we will be subject to injuries from these medical products. It's very frightening. In addition, the WHO is creating a library of potential pandemic pathogens, which is another word for biological warfare agents, is demanding that nations share these with the WHO, which will share them globally, and demanding that they the sequences be obtained in every country and then put online, which means anybody could get the sequence and then create the pathogen. It's a recipe for one pandemic after another. So they want more pandemics, but they want to limit your options to be treated safely and effectively. It's a disaster.
To the products of their funders,
products of their choice. Their sponsors want us to have.
Right. So Meryl Ness, in the remaining 30 seconds or so, what can people do if they don't want to go down this road?
Right now, you want to call your representatives and your representative and senators to make sure that the bill that passes to fund foreign operations includes the provision for the Senate to provide its advice and consent for these treaties and to defund the WHO. In addition to that...
You can do all of that. We have to leave it, I'm afraid, at that. Meryl, thank you very much. Let me just say, sovereigntycoalition.org is where you can find how to do that so efficiently. And thank you for your great leadership of that group. Meryl Ness, come back to us again soon with updates, if you would. Hope the rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.